The importance of monuments. We in the Reformation Society obviously love history, and when you think of monuments, the first thing people start thinking is like the seven wonders of the ancient world. And in the 5th century, Greek historian Herodotus described the seven wonders of the ancient world, and these were known for their size, their material, their engineering, their symbolic power. The seven wonders of the ancient world included, of course, the Great Pyramid of Chephren in Giza, which, by the way, was the tallest human man-made structure in the world until the Empire State Building was built. And there's a whole story about the people who've taken the mathematical calculations and what they work out from that, and it's absolutely extraordinary. And in fact, the four sides are so equidistant they don't differ as much as an inch. It's just, how did they do it with these massive several-ton rocks and moving them? And there's a lot to these pyramids, but at any rate, that's one of the seven ancient wonders. Then the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, which are absolutely spectacular, incredible, amazing that it's now desert there. The Temple of Artemis at Ephesus. Again, an extraordinary man-made structure. The Colossus of Rhodes, that's the island of Rhodes, where Cecil John Rhodes got his name from. And the island of Rhodes had this colossus under which ships passed. And by the way, when Cecil John Rhodes died in the Cape, one of the serious suggestions was to build a Colossus of Rhodes on Signal Hill. Can you imagine? I'm glad they settled for something far more user-friendly up at Rhodes Mem on the mountainside. The Pharos, the lighthouse of Alexandria, is absolutely famous. In the Mediterranean, looking for that lighthouse, guiding you into what was once one of the greatest port cities, one of the three greatest cities in the world, Alexandria. The statue of Zeus at Olympia was also considered one of the seven great wonders of the world, something just unbelievable in its size and in its realism. The mausoleum at Halicarnassus, which, if you've been to Kimberley, you'll probably notice a similar kind of design to the memorial to the soldiers who died in the war in Kimberley in the circle, but not as spectacularly gigantic as this one. From ancient times, temples and statues and towers and markers and tombs and other structures have defined public places, and they've extolled ideas and they've characterized societies and they've symbolized who we are. Here's the Egyptian Temple of Luxor, built in the reign of Amenhotep III. And monuments can express collective goals and joys and sorrows of a society. Some ancient monuments are a mystery. The Maui statues of East Island were carved out of soft volcanic lava and stand over 9 meters. No one knows how each 16-ton stone was moved or erected. The local people have long forgotten the purpose of these giant stones. The significance of these imposing, compelling images remains unexplained, but it's believed to represent ancestral spirits watching over the living. That's a theory. But these are colossal, they're huge, and while you often just see the head, underneath the soil is normally the full body too. Stonehenge, consisting of giant megaliths in a circle or a cromlech, is oriented towards the summer solstice. It's plainly used for some kind of religious ceremonies, and today the Wiccans, the pagans, the Satanists, they gather there in great numbers. But these gigantic stones were moved over 200 kilometers to erect this ritual circle at Stonehenge. How did they move them? Why did they move them? That's another question. It's not clear how they managed to get these giant sandstones and bluestones from the quarry site so far away. Then there's the Sphinx, which some people interpret to refer to the altar in Egypt that is spoken about in the book of Ezekiel. The Sphinx, erected over 2,500 BC, stands majestically alongside the pyramids of Giza in Egypt. So 4,500 years old, they say. And at first you can only see the head, but as they dug, they found there's a whole body of a Sphinx below it. When it was first discovered, the sand was right up to the neck, and they didn't realize how much was below to be excavated. The Sphinx, apparently the oldest colossal structure to survive from the ancient world, and it depicts a full giant hybrid beast with the body of a lion and the face of a man. The word monument comes from the Latin word monio, which means to remind. Okay, who can identify this building, for example? And then we'll ask, what is this building to remind us of? Our friends from Germany? That's Valhalla. And in Bavaria, Bayern. I've walked up those steps all the way to there. And it's, you know, in Viking and Saxon history, legend, Valhalla is the hall to which the brave warriors who are selected by the Valkyrie. The Valkyrie are these angels, so to speak, or winged women, demigods, who choose the bravest of the brave from how they die in battle and invite them to come to Valhalla, which is the greatest honor of all. And so this was built to symbolize Valhalla. Okay, why would people build a replica of something that's in myth and legend? And this is a lot of hard work. And what is Valhalla meant to remind us of? Courage, courage in battle, bravery, self-sacrifice, duty, perhaps. But interesting that you've got some magnificent monuments like this. The Temple of Ramses II, believed to be the actual Ramses of the Exodus. The one who opposed the Exodus, should we say. At Abu Simbel in Egypt. And this is huge, out of all proportion to... Normally, if you go in Europe today, or South Africa, a monument, a statue, is normally 2.5 to 3.5 times the size of a human being. But the Egyptians went to the 20, 30 times, and you haven't seen anything like that since the ancient days, until you came to the statue of Abraham Lincoln in Washington, D.C. Just, you feel like an ant. Social distancing. Yeah. Now, this, by the way, was moved from its original spot, because when the Aswan Dam was built, this entire structure would have ended up underwater. Would you believe they carefully, methodically cut to different shapes and moved and reassembled? That makes it even more extraordinary, actually, when you think of that. Very, very old. We're talking about 1,500 BC, which means 3,500 years ago, these structures were built. And then you get the Parthenon. Stands on the Acropolis overlooking the city of Athens, built between 448 and 432 BC. And inside the Pantheon was a colossal statue of the goddess Athena, after which Athens is named, of course. Now, if you know your Homer and the Iliad and Odyssey and the Siege of Troy, then you know that the war in Troy started, ostensibly according to Homer, it started because of the fact that Athena and Aphrodite, and who was the third goddess, were having a competition, and they chose this poor chap Paris, after whom the city of Paris is named, by the way, to choose who was the most beautiful. And because he chose... Sorry? No. He chose the goddess of love. What was her name? Anyway, but Athena and the other one then chose... Aphrodite. He chose Aphrodite, and Athena, out of vindictiveness along with the other goddess, then launched a war against Troy, because Paris was the prince of Troy, to destroy Troy because of the results of the first beauty competition, apparently. That's what they tell you in the Iliad and Odyssey, and this is meant to be. But this is a statue to Athena, and notice she's no pacifist. She's got a big shield, and she's got a big spear there, and all the rest of it. Sculpted in gold and ivory. Sadly, pilfered by the Turks, so we don't have that anymore. The ancient Greek female figures gazing over the city of Athens, weather worn maybe, but we're talking about 3,000 years old. A monument is anything that reminds us of a person or an event or an idea from the past, and a monument is a way in which society remembers its past and formulates its identity and achieves the future hopes. Okay, looking at this picture here, can you discern where it is, what it is, and why it is? What can you discern from here What can you tell from this? When do you think it was put up? Not possible. Look. You see the rifle there with a sling? Do you see the bullets? Cartridges were not invented before about 1850s, 1860s. So it's got to be after the 1860s, because they've got these cartridges and he's got a rifle. Okay, what else can you tell? So you know this is about mid to late 19th century. What else? You know it's the flag. Whose flag is that? Which country's flag? It's a red flag with an eagle on it. Which country has a red flag with an eagle on it? I've smuggled Bibles in there. Albania. So this is an Albanian monument, and obviously you see the cross, so obviously it's a church. So what do you deduce from that? Greece and all of the Balkans and so much of southeastern Europe was under the Turks for 400 years. From the fall of Constantinople until about 1913, you had the Turks as the main evidence, main reality in that area. And so this is a Greek or Albanian. He looks a bit Greek, but because of the kilt and all that. But it's Albanians. This is an Albanian freedom fighter who fought against the Turks for the independence of Albania in the mid-1800s. I mean, that's... I came across this picture. There's no explanation, but that's what I'm deducing just from looking at this. You can see these people are really serious about the cross. So these are Christian Albanians who fought against the Turks for the independence of Albania in the mid-19th century. Can anyone tell me what this monument is and why it's important? Who's this? Arminius. Who was he? He was the head of the German Cherusci tribe, and he's super important because in AD 9 AD, in the year of our Lord 9, the Germans under Arminius defeated 4 Roman legions, annihilated them, and thereby stopped the Roman Empire from going any further, and thereby Germany stayed out of the control of the Anglo-Saxons, from which most of us come. I mean, everyone in Britain basically comes from Anglo-Saxons and so on, for example, and the core of America and Australia and so on. It's because the Cherusci here, I've actually been to this monument. It's in the Teutoburger Forest, which today looks quite nice, but at that time was the scene of one of the most bloody battles ever. And it was so critical because it's the only thing that stopped the Romans from taking over Central Europe. And it was very well laid out by Arminius and his fighting Varus, 9 AD. And the way they deployed, you've got some rebuilt forts, which were built by the German forces to trap the Romans as they marched in to conquer the areas. And it was several days' massive battle. And at the end of it, 4 Roman legions were annihilated. Bear in mind, each legion was about 10,000 people. And it was a spectacular battle. And as a result, the Romans never dared venture across the Rhine anymore. And they said, well, whatever's on the other side of the Rhine, they can keep it. And this was the battle that preserved the Germanic countries from Roman influence. And that's why you can divide Europe's languages and everything else between the Germanic languages, of which Netherlands, Scandinavian, German, English come from the Latin cultures, which are those which were conquered by Rome, and therefore Latin dominates the Mediterranean country. So you've got Latin and you've got Germanic. And the reason why we are not Latin is because of this battle. And I've been to this monument, walked up those long stairs, and very impressive in the middle of Teutoburger Forest, reminding us of the fact that resistance against tyranny is always a good thing. Anyone recognize this individual? King Alfred the Great. He is the only king of England ever called great. He's the one who wrote the dooms. And the base of the common law of England, starting with the 10 commands of Moses, starting with the law of God, the whole of Exodus 20, 21, 22, case laws of Exodus, and the Sermon on the Mount. And this is the beginning of the common law of England. And he's the first to defeat the Vikings and the first to begin the conversion of the Vikings. Because when he defeated them, he didn't kill them. He required them to be baptized, discipled, and that was the beginning of the first Viking convert. King Alfred the Great started the English Navy. How do you defeat Vikings? You need a navy. He also is the founder of so much of English common law. He fought in 54 battles, but this Saxon king also was an educator. He found time to translate the Gospels into the Saxon language. The first of the Bible translates into English was done by King Alfred the Great, the warrior king, in the 9th century, in the 800s. 54 battles. The Vikings, of course, who conquered so much of the world, and you can even see the Viking influence in the Tower of London. The first building built in England by the Vikings when they conquered in 1066 was the Tower of London. Of course, it's been added to since. And the Viking influence seen in the flag, that the flag of England has got, just like all the other Scandinavian countries, it has the cross in it, except it's got St. Andrew's and the St. George's cross. Tower of London. One of the most famous of the Normans is King Richard the Lionheart, or the Lionhearted. And his is the only monument. Well, there's two. Two monuments inside the grounds of the Palace of Westminster, the House of Commons, and the House of Lords combined, is of Richard the Lionheart and Oliver Cromwell. And Richard the Lionhearted was king for 11 years, but he only spent 4 months in England. The rest he is in the Holy Land killing Saracens. And very much beloved by his people, a brave man. In Bruges, a statue of Jan Breydel and Peter de Koninck, the two Belgian citizens who fought against French dictators in 1302. Although, to be fair, at the time they would have called him Nederlanders. But remember, in 1830, Belgium seceded from the Netherlands. The majestic statue of Jeanne d'Arc in Orleans, showing this French Huron astride a horse, ready to lead a country to freedom. Joan of Arc epitomizes courage, integrity. Sometimes just a mark in the road can be a monument. This is in Oxford, and it marks the spot where, in the middle of Broad Street, Bishop Hugh Latimer and Bishop Nicholas Ridley and Bishop Archbishop Thomas Cranmer, the first Protestant Archbishop of Canterbury, were burned for their faith in 1555 and 1556. As the people in Cambridge University say, Cambridge produced the reformers whom Oxford burned. And, you know, to this day, the competition between Oxford and Cambridge is intense, especially when it comes to rowing. The Cambridge, all of these were Cambridge graduates, and they used to call Cambridge Little Germany because it was a hotbed of Reformation and studying the works of Martin Luther. But Oxford burned the reformers that graduated from Cambridge. Archbishop Thomas Cranmer, who produced the Book of Common Prayer, imprisoned in the Tower of London by the vindictive Bloody Mary, and burned at the stake, and he held his right hand, which had signed his oath of allegiance to Queen Mary, over the flames, saying, "This hand has offended." He produced the Book of Common Prayer, which is still used by many. And even stained glass windows can be memorials. Stained glass windows remind us of history. And here's the Martyrs' Memorial, very close to that cross in Broad Street, which is in memory of those martyrs, not only those three bishops, but a whole lot of others who were burned at the stake in Oxford for the Protestant faith. Gaspard de Coligny, the leader of the French Huguenots, the Protestants in France, who was the first victim of the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre, a brave man. His daughter, Louise, married Prince William of Orange, who's Prince William the Silent, who became the father of Dutch liberties, after whom the Orange River and the Orange Free States is named. And so he'd be the father-in-law of Prince William of Orange. Inside the grounds of Parliament, only two monuments, and one is to King Richard the Lionheart, the other to Oliver Cromwell, which is a strange choice because he, after all, overthrew the king and had the king put on trial for his life and oversaw the execution of King Charles I, who was a traitor, actually. Up to that point, nobody thought a king could be a traitor, but the reformers had put forward the principle of lex rex. Not rex lex, the king is law, but lex rex, the law is king. Taking these two Latin words, rex and lex, and inverting it. Before the Reformation, it was rex lex. The king is the law. The king's word is law. And the reformers flipped it and said, no, the law is king. All kings are under the law. All kings must uphold the law, which is what Magna Carta actually requires too. Every monarch of England must swear to uphold Magna Carta, which is thoroughly Christian and scriptural. So here you've got Oliver Cromwell standing outside Parliament with a sword, very appropriate, and his Bible. And at the base, lions. Well, Britain grew to have the strongest, most powerful army and navy in the world under him. He's the father of the first professional army in the world. And he also, by the way, innovated the red coat. The first time British soldiers wore red coats, and his logic was, you don't want the enemy to see you bleed. So they wore red coats. Which was only stopped by the Boers, because the Boers said, what nice targets these are. And so after that, they went and they became the khakis after that. Interestingly, while the communists pulled down monuments all over the old Russian Empire, they never took down Tsar Peter the Great, because even though this was erected by Empress Catherine the Great, it stands as a great symbol of Russian national pride and patriotism, because it's under Tsar Peter that they built what today is the foundation for the great Russian nation. This is a great celebration of Germany becoming a unity, the Second Reich, as it was said, in 1871. And so Germania is personified, the eagle is below, and you've got from Kaiser Wilhelm I all the way through Otto Bismarck, the Chancellor, and all the princes of Germany who united to proclaim Germany as a nation, as a unity, because Germany was at one time maybe 300 little city-states and nations. It was the most decentralized free country in all of Europe because it was so decentralized. But in 1870 and 1871, after the war with Napoleon III and the Franco-Prussian War, it was decided that in a continent full of massive national states, it was better to unify for protection, because Germany had been overrun through the 30 Years' War and so many others, destroyed by its neighbors. And unlike England, did not have a moat around it. Unlike Switzerland, wasn't set in a mountainous area and had a lot of easy plains across which hostile armies could run. And so this was chosen for defense. Here's a statue of Kaiser Frederick the Great of the 1700s, standing majestically over subjects in Berlin. You can see often you'll put leaders on horses and below they'll have many of their subjects. It was again showing status, hierarchy, all of that personified. By the way, it's also noted that, generally speaking, when you've got someone like Cecil Rhodes, who never fought in a battle, but all four hooves of the horse on the ground in the monument, when you've got one hoof off, it means he was wounded in battle. When you've got two hooves off the ground, it normally means that he's killed in the battle. That's not 100%, but it's overwhelmingly so, that the more the horse is rearing, the more injuries this poor chap suffered, and so on. Frederick the Great was such a great king that when Napoleon came to Prussia and he went to the mausoleum, the tomb of King Frederick, he ordered his generals, hats off, gentlemen, because if this man was alive, we would not be here. And he said he learned his tactics from Gustavus Adolphus, the great king of Sweden, of the 30 Years' War, and Frederick the Great, the two greatest generals before Napoleon. In Bloemfontein, outside City Hall, you can see General Christian de Wet's monument, and again you can see the horse's hooves up in the air, because he was a real battle general led from the front. Oom Paul, and by the way, we're heading up to Kruger Day. 10th of October is Kruger's Day, so on the 8th of October we will celebrate Paul Kruger's heritage. Here, without a doubt. Titanic, here's a memorial to the fact that for every woman who drowned on the Titanic, 11 men drowned. And the fact that the vast amount of men, including the richest men in the world, the most powerful men in the world, like Guggenheim and Astor, stood back and let serving women and maids take their place in the, you know, this rubbish in the Titanic film suggesting that the third class and second class passengers are locked up and not allowed. That's such rubbish. It was proven at the time with studies that this class warfare business was not there. The gentlemen stood back. And in fact, most of the men who got on the boats were the third class men and so on. The first class men overwhelmingly stood back and went down to the ship, because to them it was a gentleman gives a seat to women. This was women and children, first principle. As they also said, Birkenhead Draw. Birkenhead Draw comes from South Africa, where we had the Birkenhead sinking in 1852, and it was the women and children all got the boats, and the men went down with the ship. Not one woman or child was lost on the Birkenhead, but over 400 of the men drowned. That's the Birkenhead Draw, and that was what they said at the Titanic. Birkenhead Draw, and the gentlemen all understood, but a lot of the lower class men did not, and fought to get in the boats, whereas the richest men in the world went down with the ship. Erected to the imperishable memory of those gallant Belfast men whose names are here inscribed and who lost their lives on the 15th of April 1912 by the founding of the Belfast-built Titanic. And this was actually erected. There's one like this erected in America specifically. It says erected by the women who are survivors of the Titanic. Monuments communicate, much like books communicate. Now, for example, what is this monument communicating? Yes. You've got a young man leaving his young bride with their first baby. There's one child, baby in arms. He's got his rifle, he's got his biltong, he's got his water, he's got his ammunition. He's on his way. The horse is rearing, nostrils flared. The horse can't wait to gallop off to war. This was the upskating, separation, the farewell. This is an Anglo-Boer War Museum in Bloemfontein. So it's speaking about the beginning of the Anglo-Boer War, the farmers riding off to fight the redcoats, or in this case, the khakis. Now, this is the Reformation War. This is in Geneva. And this is a phenomenal monument. It commemorates the four great religious reformers and a whole lot of secular reformers. It will have, for example, among secular reformers, German Kaiser, Oliver Cromwell, and so on. But notice these people here. They've chosen, now although John Calvin wasn't necessarily the tallest, he's the tallest in this because he's the most prompt, and he's set forward a bit because he's the most important of these four great French or Geneva reformers. Although there's one person here who is not French, and that's the man afar up, that's John Knox. But at any rate, you've got Beza, you've got Calvin, you've got Knox. And, William Farrell right here. William Farrell, notice, while the Bible, they've all got a Bible in hand. The people here on the right have the Bible in their right hand. And John Calvin's got both hands on the Bible. But not Farrell. William Farrell's got his Bible in his left hand. And he's got his finger in the Bible. They're holding a place. Because he and his right hand's a fist. Now, this is not accidental. Nothing in a monument is accidental. Because William Farrell's the fighter. He's the debater. He's the street fighter. He would go into places like Neuchâtel and Geneva and debate. He'd first street preach, and then the soldiers come to arrest him, and he had challenged the bishop to a debate, and he'd win the debate, of course. In fact, in Neuchâtel, they can show you where the bishop tried to drown William Farrell because he couldn't defeat his argument, so he was trying to drown him in a fountain, and William Farrell wound round with a real excellent fist, knocked the bishop's lights out, went into the pulpit with his bloodstained knuckles, while his friends Formant and Barrett held the doors of the cathedral shut, and he went into the bishop's pulpit, preached the gospel, and called for the city to choose whether they wanted papal superstition or Protestant reformed Bible teaching as their principle, and the people would vote to become Protestant. He won Neuchâtel and Geneva that way. So this man, William Farrell, he's the fiery, red-headed fighter with a fist. His right hand is a fist, which is exactly what... And of course, we're getting just slightly off here, but as you can see, there's a lot in these monuments. Now, again, you've got Farrell, Calvin, Beza, Knox. Knox being on the outside. Now, notice these three are all French-speaking, primarily French-speaking. And the man on the right is actually Scottish. So he's the missing one. That's strange. Because in front now, you'll see, here's the emblem of Geneva, and Geneva's a half eagle, reminding it of its occult, of its imperial Habsburg Holy Roman Empire background. And then you've got the key of Geneva. But if you go a bit further, let's go back here. You can see Bern. You see the bear? Why Bern? Because Bern was the sponsor and the supporter of the Reformation. Bern actually sponsored William Farrell to come and to win the city of Geneva to Christ, and then helped safeguard Geneva. Now, when you get to Geneva, Geneva is surrounded on two sides, three sides, by France. And it's a sliver of Protestantism in a sea of Catholicism. And it's the Bern army, which is the strongest of the cantons in Switzerland at that time, that enabled Geneva to remain independent from the rest of France or Savoy, which later became Italy. So you've got Bern, you've got Geneva, and then you've got the Line of Scotland. What's the Line of Scotland doing? I mean, what's that fit in with the French Reformation in Geneva? Well, because of Knox. Knox turned Scotland into the most Presbyterian country on the planet. So that's another story. Everything in a monument is significant. The scale, the setting, the gestures, the expression of the human figures all convey meaning right down to what the hand's doing. And of course, in Cape Town, we've got Frontschuk, Huguenot Monument. What used to be Olifantshoek, the elephant's corner, became Frontschuk, the French corner. And this is, it looks nice now, but it was a wilderness when it was sold to them by the Dutch East India Company. They weren't given a thing. Dutch East India Company charged them, and they were paying for years, even for the spades and shovels that they took, that they were sold. And but in this beautiful setting, as you've known when we've gone for Reformation Day celebrations, everything is symbolic here. Monuments can narrate a tale or evoke a significant historic event. Tower of London. I was there in 2014, on the centenary of the beginning of the First World War. And beginning on the 4th of August, which was when Britain declared war on Germany and turned a European war into a world war, they started this cascade of poppies. And these are ceramic poppies, each poppy symbolizing a British or Empire soldier who died, which would include, of course, South Africans and Rhodesians too. And interestingly, each one of these poppies was pre-sold for £10. So it was a living memorial that people owned. And after the 11th of November 2014, people could come collect their poppies and take them home, church, wherever. And from 4th of August till the 11th of November, volunteers would come and plant these poppies. They planted 888,000 poppies. That's the number of British and Empire troops who died in the First World War. And blood swept lands and seas of red. And notice there's some poppies in the air because, of course, the air war began as well. The Royal Air Force and so on. And all the different representations of different armed forces. And people come every night and hear the names read. And they worked systematically over those 4 months, the names of those who had died in the war. And very striking. Now, this is a living memorial. And it was a temporary memorial. But it made an impact. And I don't know about what other people thought, but when I looked at this, I just saw red. I have nothing but respect for the soldiers on all sides who did their duty as best they understood it and were courageous. But the cursed politicians who sent them there. For what? For what? Christian nations fighting one another. And in fact, as some of you may know, I got my doctorate on the greatest century of missions, the 19th century. And I've since then been working on why the 20th century was derailed into the worst century of persecution. In 1910, at the world's first missions conference, Christians ruled the world, with the exception of Japan and China and the Ottoman Empire, which was crumbling. The rest of the world was controlled by Christians, and mostly by Protestant nations, the superpowers of all, Germany, Britain, America, or Catholic countries, such as France and Austria, or Orthodox, such as Russia. And the world was run by Christians, overwhelmingly. And today, can you find one single country that's truly Christian? from the government down. What changed? What the 20th century got the greatest century of missions derailed into the worst century of persecution. More Christians died in the 20th century for their faith, persecuted, than all other 19th centuries combined. And it all started with the First World War. And the role of the banksters, these cursed Rothschilds, who were involved in the Freemasonry and an anti-Christian agenda, and what a brilliant agenda. So you had Lord Nathan Rothschild, who controlled the Bank of England, and his sons controlled the banks of France, Italy, Germany, America, Austria. The only country in Europe they didn't control was Russia. And the main goal of the First World War was to destroy the Tsar and destroy the Russian royal family. And that was done the most bloodthirsty, disgusting way, as we looked at earlier, in the murder of the Russian royal family. And to get Russia under a Rothschild control bank. That was the first goal of the war. Later on, they developed other goals as well, like the Balfour Declaration, how you could have arms races and get more countries into debt and have more wars than ever before and make people more impoverished. But the result was the impoverishing of Europe. Christianity was the biggest casualty of the First World War. Before the First World War, 64% of Europe went to church every Sunday. By the beginning of the Second World War, it was 42%. After the Second World War, it went down to 4% of Europe was in church every Sunday. And the First World War is what derailed Christian civilization. So I look at this and I see red. Although we still remember, Mark, I'm chaplain for the Rhodesia Remembrance Services on 11th of November. We always commemorate those who died. And my home on 2014, 4th of August, which marked the beginning of the First World War, all lights out just one candle to commemorate the beginning of that war. Battle sites are also often monuments, like the Battle of Waterloo, 1815. And I had relatives on both sides, well, at least on the Allied side, Lindemann's from the German side and Hammond's on the British side, who fought and died there, fighting the French. And they've put the most incredible monument up there, the lion representing the Netherlands defeating the French revolutionary forces. The Alamo in San Antonio, Texas began as a Spanish mission station, but today it's the monument to the battle at the Alamo, which basically led to the independence of Texas from Mexico. Eastern Luana, one of the most incredible battles in South African history, and Zulu MPs wiped out a British regiment to the man. And great courage on both sides. This is the memorial to the Zulu warriors. This is the necklace with the lion's claws. This represents courageous warriors. Majuba, one of the most stunning Boer victories. Calvin and I have climbed to the top of that. And we've been to the house at the bottom where they signed the treaty that ended that first Anglo-Boer War. You go to the Women's Monument and the War Museum of the Boer Republics, and there's the Uffsgate Monument. Very impressive, heartrending. It really communicates. It just shows, like a book, a monument can communicate. And they've got a wall of the names of all the Boer soldiers, commandos who died between 1899 and 1902. And they specify whether they were killed in action, died of wounds, or of disease. 5,600 in total. I couldn't find the pictures just now, but I've got pictures somewhere in my archives of the new war on the other side, which has 33,000 names of women and children who died in the British concentration camps. What kind of war has six times more women and children dying than the men? That's not the way it's meant to be. Before the Anglo-Boer War, before the 20th century, civilians were only about 5% of the casualties, normally about 4% of the casualties when Christian nations were involved, such as in Europe. To see Christian nations targeting civilians, which began with the 20th century with the British concentration camps in South Africa, just staggering to think of the impact. Today, the largest tribe in South Africa would be the Afrikaners. They'd outnumber the Zulus by far if it hadn't been for the 33,000 lost at that key time, at a time when an average woman was having 12 children. So you can imagine what that did to the population growth at a critical time, burning the farms, putting the people into bell tents in the middle of the desert, or in place where there was snow and ice, such as Bethlehem and Bloemfontein. It was absolutely nauseating. So the Women's Monument's a very moving, compelling monument to remind us of our heroines and beloved children, your will be done. And the numbers they had at that stage, they put 26,000 at that stage. That's what they knew from the statistics of Emily Hobhouse, but the details have come out since. And this isn't thumbsucking. They've got the names, the dates, the place on the walls. As they've done the research, they found, oh, we underestimated dramatically. It was a lot more than that. And Emily Hobhouse, the courageous British woman who exposed to the world the atrocities of the British force under Alfred Milner, after whom this Milner Road is named, and Lord Kitchener, she is buried there for freedom, folk, and fatherland. The Run Ye Blun Ye Blow of the Orange Free State, the Barnaling, the exiled people were exiled as far as the Bahamas and St. Helena and Ceylon, and many went back as missionaries afterwards. And this is the monument to the Bitter Ainda. And here he is dressed in rags and sackcloth, but he's still got his Mauser, and he's got his bandolier, and his horse looks really worn out, but he's not giving up. This is the Bitter Ainda, which is epitomized by General De Wet and President Steyn of the Orange Free State, the Bitter Ainda. They'll fight to the bitter end, a Bitter Ainda. So you can see others have laid down their arms, but he's still fighting. When everyone else surrenders, he'll... So in South Africa at the time, they spoke about the Hensoppers, the Hands-Uppers, and the Bitter Ainders. So they are Hensoppers, we are Bitter Ainders. That kind of, that was the idea.
And the joiners.
Sorry? They were the ones who actually went and fought on the other side. It may be a shock to some to know that someone as wonderful as General Christian De Wet, his own brother, was not just a Hensopper. He went and he joined the British forces to fight against his... So one of the greatest heroes of the Anglo-Boer War, Christian De Wet, his brother was on the other side. He didn't start on the other side, but he ended up on the other side. Monuments elicit nostalgia and pride and empathy and sorrow and compassion and respect, even more powerfully than a written word can do. To go... Now, this is Lindisfarne. Lindisfarne is the oldest of the... monasteries in England, which was devastated by the Vikings. The Vikings came in 793 from Norway. Could have been relatives of ours for all we know. Miss Hammonds came to England through the Vikings and destroyed this wonderful mission station. And there's a lot of stories there. Today you can go to Armenia and there is a memorial to the first genocide where the word was used, and that was the Armenian Genocide of 1915. The Turks used the chaos of the First World War to wipe out 1.5 million, minimum, of Armenian Christians. And that's not counting the Greek and Assyrian Christians. If you put them together, it comes to 3.75 million Christians wiped out by the Turks between 1915 and 1917. This is the memorial to the Armenian Christians. Now, this isn't Arminian, as in the theological persuasion of Arminianism. This is Armenians. They are in the Caucasian Mountains, and it's where Noah's Ark ended. Mount Ararat, the mountains of Ararat, are in Armenia. So this is in Armenia, which used to be part of the Soviet Union. And, of course, most of the Armenians were in what today we call Turkey. They were wiped out in Turkey. Of course, they can't have a monument there, but they've got the monument nearby Armenia, which fought for their freedom against Azerbaijan in Nagorno-Karabakh. Maybe you know of that name. Nagorno-Karabakh is a little island of Armenian Christians surrounded by Azerbaijan Turks, Muslims who were fighting them, and they actually won their freedom and fought to join Armenia. But this is a very poignant memorial with a perpetual flame to remind one of the Armenian Christians who died in that. Can anyone identify this monument? I can tell you where it is. It's Ukraine. It's a memorial to the Holodomor, to the 11 million Christian Ukrainians deliberately starved to death by Stalin in 1932 to 1933. In less than a one-year period, they killed 11 million people by starvation. If you haven't seen the film, the dramatic film, which is in the library, Bitter Harvest, that dramatizes it. Bitter Harvest is well worth seeing. It's made by Ukrainians who fled to Canada and have made this film, Bitter Harvest, to commemorate the victims of the forced starvation. That was the first land reform expropriation without compensation. They called it dekulakization. And there are memorials to that. Now, you can go to Poland and you'll get many memorials to the Katyn Forest Massacre, but this is actually in Russia, near Smolensk, where the Katyn Forest Massacre took place. And today they're able to have their memorials up there commemorating. And this monument tells you something. Here is an angel cradling an officer. His hat is on the ground. The Katyn Forest Massacre was the Soviets murdered over 26,000 officers, the cream of Poland. See, his hands are bound behind his back. You can see his hands tied behind his back. Shot, hat has fallen, the angel is cradling. Well-designed monuments communicate. And as there were three crosses on Calvary, so you've got here, and they've got, Katyn was the main massacre, and then the other two massacres to the side commemorated. And this is, in America, the memorial to Katyn, 1940, the rifle with a bayonet stabbed in the back, because Russia was meant to be, the Soviet Union was meant to be the ally of Poland and Britain and America. And it was stabbed in the back by their ally, murdered and lied to. In fact, it was worse than that, because General Sikorsky, head of the Polish government in exile, was murdered on the request of FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, by Churchill in Gibraltar in 1943, because he insisted on an international Red Cross investigation to the Katyn Forest Massacre. And Roosevelt contacted Churchill and said, we've got to get rid of him. And so the Polish commander-in-chief, stabbed in the back, murdered by his own people, by the British and Americans, to please Stalin, but betrayed by all the allies. And you can see here again, standing on the edge of the pit with their hands tied behind their backs. And here you've got an empty cross. So again, a lot of thought has gone into these memorials for the Polish people. Because monuments are generally intended to be permanent, to educate and to remind future generations of values and personalities and events deemed significant, many monuments have been made of lasting materials such as stone and marble and bronze and iron and steel. And this is the oldest building still in use in the Southern Hemisphere. However, monuments can also be traditions. The fact that we have a seven-day week is a monument, a reminder to the fact that God created the world in 6 days and he rested on the seventh. And the institution of Sunday as the day of rest is a monument to the fact that the Lord Jesus Christ rose from the dead on the first day of the week. Nothing else could explain how we moved from the seventh-day Jewish Sabbath, Hebrew Sabbath, to the first day of the week, Lord's Day, than the fact that the Lord Jesus Christ rose from the dead. There's an empty tomb in Jerusalem. He is not here. He is risen. The term holiday comes from the term holy day. Funny how a lot of people think, oh, I don't need to go to church, it's a holiday. We don't need Bible studies, but that's when people used to go to churches on holy days. The holidays that a nation chooses have great cultural significance, like Christmas, the incarnation, the importance of Easter, Good Friday, the Atonement, Resurrection Sunday, or Ascension Day. And so a society's calendar should revolve around our faith. The farewell greeting, goodbye, comes from the old English prayer, God be with you. That's the etymology of the word. Goodbye. Why the Y? Where's the bye come from? God be with ye, abbreviated goodbye. If you go to Austria today, the people still greet you as with Gruß Gott. Greetings in God. You go to Switzerland, it's Grüezi, which is an abbreviation of that. However, monuments are not only buildings and sculptures, but also books and manuscripts. And studying manuscripts is very important. What we call Fox's Book of Martyrs was first published in English in 1563 entitled Acts and Monuments of These Latter and Perilous Days. So it was particularly to remember those who had been martyred from the Roman Emperor days all the way through to Bloody Mary and the Inquisition. Acts and Monuments. If you have a book of Fox Book Martyrs, it should acknowledge the original title. Our book, Greatest Century Reformation, is meant to be a monument too. Make it plain. This book, the Black Book of Communism, 900 pages, something can drop on a liberal's foot and he will limp. This is they call it a monument to the millions of people, 100 million people who were killed by the communists according to own records, just between 1917 and 1991. I mean, you take these books. When I've been in Parliament for subcommittees on things like gun control, I've taken Black Book Communism, I lifted off that and I've dropped it. Big thud and everyone sort of jumps. And sort of, in this book, so you sort of make your point, you have your research with you, and just... In Britain, they have got a monument to Magna Carta, the most valuable piece of paper in the world. Well, it's not actually not paper, it's vellum, it's made, it's on a leather. But this one page was sold for something in the region of 20-something million pounds recently. And the seal of John Lewis goes back to 1215. The first statute, the first written restriction of powers of government, the barons of England forced at the point of the sword, as you can see, John, who wants to be known as John I, but he's bound to be known as John the Worst, forced him to sign this document limiting the powers of government. Now, the Australian government has a 1297 charter. So Magna Carta was reissued at different times, and this is an original 1297 charter, which is on display in the Members' Hall of Parliament House, Canberra. And they built the whole thing around the epicenter of the whole Parliament buildings is this Magna Carta, 1217. They've built the entire Australian Parliament over, directly under the Australian flag is Magna Carta. That's how they've designed it. And so it's an interesting thing. When I went to Australia just a while ago, this is it. This is in Parliament House. It's an original. And so I was outside a abortion clinic in downtown Brisbane, a demonstration. By the way, in Brisbane, it's illegal to do abortions. According to the laws of Queensland, abortion is still legal, but they don't enforce the law. So there we are, protesting outside this abortion clinic. And along comes the police and orders us to move. So the pastor, who I was guest of, said, "What law have we broken?" He said, "No, you haven't broken the law, but I'm ordering you to leave." So he said, "But if we haven't broken the law, why are we being asked to leave?" "Because the people inside there have said that you're making them feel uncomfortable." And he said, "Do you know what they're doing in there?" And I said, "I have no idea." He said, "They're killing babies." And the man says, "Well, still, I'm ordering you to leave. And if you don't leave, well, I'll have you arrested. But what law have we broken?" "They haven't broken the law. But you know they're killing babies in there. Do you know abortion's against the law in Queensland?" The policeman raised his hand and said, "That's above my pay grade." And he continued to issue a ticket warning us that if we came back within 24 hours there, he would have us arrested. What for? For disobeying the commands of policemen. But what law have we broken? Doesn't matter. I'm giving an order. And so I mentioned Magna Carta, first item of which is freedom of religion. And he said, "You don't sound like you're from around here. Where do you come from?" "South Africa." "I want to see your passport and so on. You know, you have no right to be involved in a demonstration. You're not a citizen of this country." And, I mean, wow. Welcome to George Orwell's 1984 and the Thought Police. And a reminder about Magna Carta, he said, "What's Magna Carta?" I said, "Your entire parliament is built over Magna Carta. It's an epicenter. You just celebrate the 800th anniversary of it in Parliament." Said, "Well, I don't know about that." A policeman who doesn't know about the law. But there's a lot of countries around which are built like that, around the law. There are churches that are built as memorials. This is Martyrs Memorial Free Presbyterian Church in Northern Ireland, the church of Ian Paisley. And he's got in metal outside the door Luther's 95 Theses and a whole lot of other great things like that too. Very much a martyr's memorial. He's got memorials to different martyrs through the ages. And he's quite straightforward. "We preach Christ crucified." Ian Paisley, number one enemy of the IRA. He had more security than the British Prime Minister because he had so many death threats on him. He was at the top of their hit list. And so he had security equal to the Queen of England. And he said, "Yeah, for the last 30-something years, I haven't had to buy a car or petrol because he's driven by police and armored car everywhere. And because he's a target for some RPG from some IRA character." Didn't seem to quieten him down, though. And this is Martyrs Memorial Church. So an entire church can be a memorial as well. In fact, all of our churches should be memorials. This is a Wednesday night meeting in the church, by the way. And it's the prayer meeting outside Stormont, which is the parliament in Belfast, Northern Ireland. Music can be a memorial. Just think of Handel's Messiah and think of Bach's Matthew's Passion and many other great musical items. Some monuments were meant initially to be temporary. For example, the Eiffel Tower in Paris was erected for the 1889 International Exposition and meant to be dismantled shortly afterwards. However, over the years, the Eiffel Tower became synonymous with the city of Paris and so has remained a permanent structure in the physical, emotional landscape of France. When Gustave Eiffel built the Mammoth Tower on the left bank of the Seine River for the 1889 International Exposition, his goal was to display the potential of new industrial metals for architecture. Here's Gustave Eiffel. At the time, the tower was highly controversial and many 19th century Parisians criticized being un-French in its design, which is hilarious. However, the Eiffel Tower survives because of its practical use as a radio. As radio came into vogue shortly after that, they kept it for that purpose. There's much in monuments which is symbolic. The 49 steps up Rhodes Memorial symbolize the 49 years that Cecil Rhodes lived. And the 36 Doric columns of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. symbolize the number of states, the 36 states in the Union at the time of the president's death. And the Statue of Liberty in New York City is personified as a robed woman standing on broken chains representing tyranny. The broken chains. Monuments help people feel connected with their collective past, their common tradition, their shared experience. Anyone identify where this is? Zuidwest Africa. Deutsche Zuidwest Africa, actually. The Lutheran Church, and this is the trooper on the horse. The cross symbolizes for people across many nationalities and language groups plainly our Christian identity. And this is the Celtic cross. By the way, if you pronounce it Celtic and you are in Northern Ireland or Scotland, they will correct you and say, no, it's Celtic. It might be spelled with a C, but it's pronounced with a K. It's a Celtic cross. Many monuments embody the virtues that a society wants to hold dear, such as liberty and justice and freedom and courage. Jeanne d'Arc, for example. The cross with a sword in it symbolizes a war memorial. In Belgium, you have got more graves per square mile than probably anywhere else on earth. And some portray, like here, the Australian digger carrying a wounded comrade. Here, a Belgian memorial. Here's the Cobbers. This is a new memorial I saw last time. It was in Belgium. And, this, of course, the Scottish. Here you've got, I think, the Canadians. And there are so many war memorials, so many precious young lives snuffed out for this worthless, meaningless war. But, of course, you must still honor the memory of the people. An angel offering a wreath was a run the race, fought the good fight of faith. And here again, the wreath being offered. In the Roman Empire, you would get the wreath, like we get a gold medal now for your athletic achievement. So the wreath was a symbol of having won the race. I've run the race, I've kept the faith. And of course, tragically, horses were a major part of the First World War. And so to have memorials to the horses is also seriously important. Many horses lost their lives in the war. And here's a memorial, which is, I mean, it's quite poignant. This is dedicated to all the animals who perished in the war. And this is particularly, you can see stirrups and horses, horseshoes. And one of the most lovely memorials to the horses is a horse trough in Port Elizabeth, commemorating the many horses that entered this country through Port Elizabeth. And sadly, some EFF thugs have targeted this memorial and damaged it. But this is a practical one because this provides to this day for dogs and horses going past a water trough. South Africa has a little piece of France where thousands of South Africans are buried who were part of this Battle of the Somme. Britain lost more men in 4 months of that one battle in the Somme than on all sides in all 6 years of the Second World War on all fronts. They threw away 650,000 lives and gained 4 miles of territory, which they lost shortly thereafter. And South Africa had the job of getting Delville Wood, and we did. And other sides failed. And so they were surrounded on three sides. Langemark is where the German soldiers in Belgium are buried. Simple crosses, simple memorials to the soldiers of the different units, of the different branch of service. Army, Navy, Air Force, Medical Corps. I have called you by name, you are mine. From Isaiah 43 verse 1. The wreath. In Zambia, there is a memorial to where the last action of the First World War took place. General von Letlow Vorbeck, the unbeaten general of German East Africa, Tanganyika, he had made fools of everyone, ran the British, South Africans, Rhodesians, ragged. Jan Smuts gave up and came home. Louis Botha gave up and came home. None of them could beat General von Letlow Vorbeck. And in the end, he was in Zambia, Northern Rhodesia, what then was Northern Rhodesia. And a British dispatch rider came over on a motorbike to them and said, you know, the war's over in Europe. It's been over for the last week or so. And said, yes, we know it. And they said, well, we need you to surrender. And he said, you haven't beaten us in battle. You want a rematch? Come fight. He said, okay, you can keep your weapons, keep your flags. So they gave him, Jan van Etler, Vorbeck and his officers' men were given great banquets all the way back to the coast and set back to Berlin, and they had a victory parade through the Brandenburg Gates because they were undefeated and they wore everyone out. 4 years in the field, totally outnumbered, and what the group under General von Letlow Vorbeck did was just astounding. Even generals who should have known better, like Jan Smuts and Louis Botha, he did to them what they did to the British, but better. And so this is a commemoration of the German forces who ended the war in Northern Rhodesia, what today is Zambia, and Zambia had a commemoration of it. If you've seen Joyeux Noël, the film on the Christmas truce, you remember about the football, playing soccer in the no man's land. So here in 1999, on the 85th anniversary of that Christmas truce, the Australians came and they put their little flags in and left some footballs and wreaths in commemoration of that unforgettable night when the guns went silent and all sides, hundreds of thousands of men on the Western Front and even more on the Eastern Front, stopped fighting, came over, had worship services, swapped ration packs, and probably wondered, what are we doing here? Because, you know, these cursed politicians, in fact, it was said by many of these men, my father is in North Africa, he said, we felt closer to the Africa Corps on the other side than we did to our own politicians and civilians and even family back home. They were going through the same things, they were suffering the same heat stroke, drought, thirst, everything else we were, foot rot, trench, fever, the whole deal. And we knew that our opponent in the other trench, they understood. They could sympathize. But the people back home didn't even understand. So we felt more affinity to our enemies than we did to our people back home. But every year, 11th of November, there's, of course, at the Memorial Day in Britain, they know how to put on a good service and show. Some monuments become synonymous with the cities they occupy. To many, the Eiffel Tower symbolized Paris, and the Colosseum is Rome. And yet, remember, Christians died in the Colosseum by the thousands. They were murdered and martyred for the faith over centuries. Tower Bridge is very much a symbol of London as well. Magnificent example of a symbolization of city. The famous bell tower, Big Ben, is dear to the hearts of Londoners, and it's a symbol of the city. But the name Big Ben does not refer to the tower. It refers to the largest bell, which is 13 and a half tons. This is actually Big Ben. This is the bell. You don't want to be close to that when that goes off. There have been a few films where people are dangling on that clock face. I don't know if you've noticed, but if you go to Cape Town City Hall, it's got a miniature replica. It's one-third the size of that, but it's an exact replica. of Big Ben in our city hall. And can anyone tell me who this monument is to, just below Big Ben? Queen Boadicea. She led the revolt against the English in the, back in the days of the Romans, and led them in a chariot. I don't know if you can see the scythe coming out the side of the wheel to cut Roman infantry. Many town governments depict their monuments on banners and city seals and number plates and other official objects, like this is Cologne. And when you look at this city, remember this city was the first city destroyed by 1,000 bomber raids, and they rebuilt everything, including the cathedral. In Renaissance Italy, bell towers were erected as symbols of the city's wealth and prominence. And when construction began in 1174, the Tower of Pisa was intended to be just such a prestigious symbol. But the ill-fated monument began to list to one side right from the beginning, even before they'd completed it. And all subsequent efforts to stabilize its weak foundations have failed. But today, the Leaning Tower of Pisa is the most famous of all the Tuscan bell towers, precisely because of its curious angle. And that it's still standing is amazing. In many cities, the public monuments define their civic identity, like Zurich and Ulrichsvingli, they go together. Or Jan Hus and Prague, which inseparable. Wenceslas Square, the forerunner of the Reformation. And Gutenberg, you go to Strasbourg and Mainz. They are proud of the inventor of the printing press. In fact, when we were going into the new millennium, Gutenberg was voted man of the millennium. And who's influenced the last millennium more than, if you didn't have the printing press, you wouldn't have had the Reformation, you wouldn't have had information revolution, industrial revolution, so many things. So interesting that newspapers voted him the man of the millennium because, well, of course, newspapers are built on print, so it makes sense. Wittenberg and Martin Luther, inseparable. And to go to Wittenberg on the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther nailing 95 theses, you can just imagine the everything, every tile and cobble in the city shone. And this is Dresden. And to think that this monument was blown off its pedestal and this entire church gutted and burned out in the Dresden firebombing, and they rebuilt it all. That's why you see some black bricks. Those are some of the burnt bricks from the bombing. And again, his hand is firmly on the Bible. Sola Scriptura. Scripture alone is the ultimate authority. And he's looking up to God for his guidance and vindication. Here is the epicenter of the Reformation. This is the Castle Church, Schlosskirche, where the 95 Theses were nailed. And, of course, the tower wasn't there at the time. That was built later. And in fact, by Kaiser Wilhelm II. And it's got Ein Festeberg, ist unser Gott, a mighty fortress that got the battle hymn of the Reformation, around the top of the tower. And been there many times, especially in 2017. This is the actual door way, although the wooden door itself was burned up in the Napoleonic Wars, but this is in metal. Kaiser Wilhelm II sponsored the restoration of this church, and they've got the whole 95 Theses in metal on the door. And what a magnificent, incredible church. And just to show you how some people don't get it, I had a group of people from America come for this, and I was giving guided tour of the Schlosskirche, and it was about halfway through, and one of the people said, "So this is the Catholic Church." I think sometimes people miss the point. There was a Reformation. And yeah. So Martin Luther is actually buried under his pulpit on order of the prince. Although back then Latin was the language of the intellectual, so the inscription is in Latin. But what a magnificent church to visit. And Wartburg Castle, this is where the New Testament in German was translated in a blitzkrieg of something like 13 weeks. It was unbelievable that he had the Bible so clear in his mind that he could just take the Greek New Testament translated into German in such a short time without modern typewriters or anything like that. I mean, of course. So imagine a 13-week blitzkrieg to be able to translate the New Testament. Boggles the brain. Eisleben, the city where Martin Luther was born and where he died, extraordinarily. And obviously here you've got him wearing his doctoral cap of a professor of the university. And you've got where he was born, and wears R covers. And then in Worms, next year will be the 500th anniversary of the Here I Stand, I Can Do Nothing, My Conscience Kept the Word of God, Stand Before the Emperor. And so this Reformation monument in Worms is very interesting. Luther, of course, is in the center. But two cities are mentioned, Magdeburg and Augsburg. And then some princes and kings are mentioned, like Frederick III and Philip I, because they were defenders of the Reformation. You can see the sword up there. And then you can also see Melanchthon at the back. And at the base of the monument are pre-reformers. John Wycliffe, the morning star of the Reformation in Britain, the professor of Oxford. Peter Waldo, the leader of the Waldensians in southern France. Jan Hus of Prague, the professor of Prague University, who was burned at the stake for his faith at Council of Constance. Girolamo Savonarola, the reformer of Florence. And Philip Melanchthon, the Greek professor, and also Johannes Reuchlin, the great uncle of Philip Melanchthon. So these are part of it, and you can see it's recognizing that while one reformer stands above them all, the Reformation was a work of many, and it was not only religious leaders and educators, but there was also political leaders who protected them and provided the space where it was possible. Here I stand, I cannot do otherwise, God help me. Ulrich Zwingli's monument in Zurich. They may kill the body, but they cannot kill the soul. I had a pastor in Switzerland ask me, why does Frontline Fellowship have a sword and a banner? I said, for the same reason that Ulrich Zwingli's monument out there is carrying a sword. And he said, what? You have to go to the window and look out. And some had missed that sword. Well, the sword of the Spirit, the Word of God, it goes together. But you can actually see Ulrich Zwingli's actual sword and his helmet in the museum in Zurich. And although his house is built with wood, and he was born there over 500 years ago, you can go to Wildhaus, 3,000 feet up in the Alps, and find his house is still there. How's that for good building standards? That's a work ethic. William Tyndale, the father of the English Bible, he's got his traveling printing press because he had to print on the go. And so this is a monument that you get in England, even though he had to translate the English Bible in Germany and have it printed in Germany and smuggled into England. Can anyone identify this reformer? We've mentioned him before. William Farel, the great French-speaking Swiss debater, holding the Bible above all, sola scriptura. And here you've got Saint-Pierre, the cathedral where John Calvin launched the Reformation. See the Swiss flag, the Geneva flag, but what's that over there? It's a fountain in Lake Geneva, symbolizing the fountain of knowledge and of freedom and of liberty. In fact, under the Reformation, you had the greatest concentration of printing presses the world had ever seen. The biggest had been in Wittenberg under Luther, but this is the second generation reformer, John Calvin. Printing presses multiplied, and more refugees. There were, in fact, more refugees living in Geneva than there were citizens, because it was a place of refuge for abused women, for English people fleeing the persecution under Bloody Mary and others. So the fountain represents a lot of things. But again, a fountain can be a monument too. The church where John Calvin preached. The monument, and that gives you a bit of a perspective between our sizes and the Reformation War. John Knox of Scotland, give me Scotland or I die. Again, you notice in each one of these, the Bible. Scripture alone is the ultimate authority. The Statue of Liberty is the most famous colossal statue since the Colossus of Rhodes, which was destroyed in an earthquake. But New York Statue of Liberty is dedicated in 1886, although it was meant to symbolize the centenary, which of course would be 1776, means 1876, but it took that long for it to actually get assembled. And here you can see the size, if you can see the size of the people, and this is as parts of it were being prepared and ready to be shipped over to America. They were raising funds by getting people to see some of these. And you see you could actually go up into it and stand around the flames. So there's stairway up the way. And so this is an impressive symbol. Again, you've got the book, you've got a star, and you've got a flame indicating a flame of freedom. The Romans erected triumphal arches throughout the territories to celebrate military victories. In the Ark of Constantine, Rome is one of the triumphal arches erected by Roman emperors serving as emblems of power. And this is historically interesting because you can see the menorah, the seven-pointed candlestick, as symbolic of the Hebrew nation being carried as loot into Rome as part of the triumphal procession in the sack of Rome, which is a fulfillment of the prophecies in the Gospels and Jesus predicting this will happen because they rejected and his blood be upon us and upon our children and we have no king but Caesar. Napoleon Bonaparte sought to emulate his ancient predecessors by erecting the Arc de Triomphe in Paris to stir patriotism at home by symbolizing military victories abroad. But you know why the Champs-Élysées is with trees on both sides? So that the German army can march in the shade. Which they did in 1870, in 1914, 1940. Do you know how many soldiers it takes to defend Paris? Nobody knows. It's never been tried. There's sculptures on the side of the Arc de Triomphe depicting the ideals of liberty, productivity, and freedom. And so you see the spear, the sword. Behind that protection, you can be productive and free. Well, I think Napoleon would be pretty unimpressed with how his descendants handled things later. Nelson's Column in Trafalgar Square in London stands 44 meters above the ground. It commemorates a great naval victory at the Battle of Trafalgar in 1815. And it's got the lions at the base. Oh, and look at that lovely flag there. That's South Africa House right behind. That's orange, white and blue. Here's South Africa House, the Springbok out the front there. And I would come out, have tea on the balcony whenever I was visiting England. I'd visit the military attaché and we'd go in the rooibos tea and chat between my different appointments. But what a lovely view from here. And got a few stories about that. But this is impressive. And the lion, the regal lion representing the empire. And these are almost as good as our lions we've got up at Rhodesmen. The sculptures, the base commemorates his naval victories, especially the Battle of Trafalgar, but also St. Vincent in 1797, and the Nile in 1799, and the Battle of Copenhagen when he famously put the telescope to his blind eye because he is told to disengage and he didn't want to disengage. So that's what turning a blind eye comes from. Copenhagen, the fleet, was the British did this twice. Even though Denmark was neutral, just in case they decided to join the French, which they never did, they went and destroyed without a declaration of war and without warning. They went and destroyed the whole Danish fleet and did it twice. And the British or the Royal Navy trained the Japanese Navy. And so people have said that Pearl Harbor was a complete surprise, a completely unprecedented surprise attack. Obviously, they hadn't studied the history and they're not being honest because they were trained by the British that when you've got a potential enemy, you Copenhagen their fleet, which means you attack their fleet at anchor and destroy them before they could become a threat. And that's the Royal Navy who trained the Japanese. And the Japanese did exactly what the British did to the Danish, Copenhagen the fleet. And what the British have just done to the Italian Navy at Taranto, using aircraft flying off aircraft carriers to attack the fleet at anchor in Taranto Bay. And that happened a few months before the Battle of Pearl Harbor. And yet we are meant to believe this nonsense they keep giving us to this day that Pearl Harbor was completely unprecedented. Never been done before. Well, Nelson did it. Cunningham did it. Also Italy with Copenhagen, the fleet of Italy as well. And the fact that they were trained, the Japanese Navy was totally trained by the Royal Navy. They should have known. This was Lord Nelson's strategy right from A to Z. South Africa House, Trafalgar Square at night. Notice this monument, which kind of reminds us again from this general that you might never have heard of, General Havelock, but he says, "Soldiers, your labors, your privations, your suffering, and your valor will not be forgotten by a grateful country." Now, that's why you put up war memorials, because the sacrifices men are meant to be remembered. And taking down those monuments is actually a crime. The Great Wall of China, and Hadrian Wall, these are monuments to attempts by civilization to protect people and possessions from foreign attacks. The most impressive of which is the Great Wall of China. the one human-made instrument in the world that can be seen from outer space, they say. I haven't been there, but that's what they tell me. 2,414 kilometers across the Asian continent to keep the Mongols out. Hadrian's Wall, built by the Romans to keep the Picts and the Scots out, 129 kilometers, separating England from Scotland. The first line of defense for the ancient Romans, now rambling ruin, marking the border between Scotland and England. And the Brandenburg Gate, probably the most famous gate of all. Originally erected in Berlin in 1791 as a symbol of peace. For years, the Brandenburg Gate symbolized the Cold War, the Iron Curtain, the Berlin Wall, the separation of communist-enslaved Eastern Europe from the West, the flashpoint of conflict between totalitarianism and freedom, the Leipzig prayer meeting, the protests, the prayers, the peaceful protests, the candlelight praying on the wall, and finally, 1989, the coming down of the Berlin Wall. Physically taken down by the people. Not by governments, not by politicians. The people took it in hand and dismantled the wall. And celebrations like Europe had not seen in decades. And I don't know if you'd noticed, but in the previous pictures, the horse and rider is always facing towards the west. But the communists turned it around to face towards the east. And now, since it's been liberated, you can see the horse has been turned around, the chariot rider to face towards the west again, which is what always was meant to be. At the 25th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall in 2014, they followed all the way along where the wall had been with lighted balloons. And these were helium-filled balloons, and at a key point they released them, symbolized the releasing or destruction of the wall. Symbolically, light shone through, and freedom. Interestingly here, you can see the freedom coming from the west. So that's the back of the chariot. Light coming in from west to east, which actually isn't too true, because it was the prayer meetings behind the Iron Curtain that brought down the wall. It was not outside efforts from the west as much as inside protests from the east that brought down the wall, to be fair. But still, that's just the symbolism they used. But this is wonderful because since the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, it's again become a symbol of freedom and resistance to oppression. And it's now again what it always was meant to symbolize, resistance and peace. Mount Rushmore in the Black Hills of South Dakota started as a tourist attraction because what will bring people to North Dakota? What do they have in South Dakota, for that matter, south from Buffalo? And so somebody came up with this idea, and he first wanted to put the names of famous Westerners and so on, and then just thought, but that wouldn't bring as much tourists as presidents. So they put the president's face on it, and George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Theodore Roosevelt, Abraham Lincoln. Now, somebody once said, will they ever build a monument to homeschoolers? Well, here it is. All these people were homeschooled. And here it is from a distance. And these are 60-foot high faces, and they're 500 feet above the ground. But the largest relief sculpture in the world is Stone Mountain, commemorating Southern leaders General Stonewall Jackson, Robert E. Lee, President Jefferson Davis. And this is 400 feet above the ground, and they're 90 by 190 feet. Now, this is quite impressive. You can see the size of people down there. That's pretty impressive. In Berlin, the Kaiser Wilhelm Gedenkstätte remains as a reminder of the destruction of the bombing of Berlin by the remaining bomb-scarred bell tower standing next to the new cathedral. And Danilo's actually sung there with the Cape Town Youth Choir in that cathedral. An amazing work. The Peace Park in Hiroshima in Japan commemorates the victims of the first atomic bomb ever dropped on a city, 6th of August, 1945. And you can see the dome of the hospital, which was the epicenter of the blast. The Enola Gray superfortress targeted the bomb to detonate directly above the hospital dome. And so they've left the hospital dome exactly as it was since then. As a commemoration, they've rebuilt everything else around the city, but not that. And on another day, we could deal with the Fortrekker Monument, which is replete with magnificent symbolism. But any questions, any comments?
The Witkruis Monument is also a very...
That's a good example to bring prominent. Up. Very effective, too.
So why are they being so targeted?
Monuments. The first battlefield is the rewriting of history, said Karl Marx. So the communists see history as very important, because what did George Orwell write in 1984? That to control the future, you must control the present. And to control the present, you need to control the past. And so to change the future to what you want, you need to alter the history to comport with what party policy is now. And that's why in 1984 they said every monument has been pulled down, every street has been renamed, every date has been altered until the past disappears and you only have an endless present in which the party is always right. I'm quoting straight from George Orwell from 1984. So that's prophetic document from 1948, looking at the future based on what he saw in Stalin, Soviet Union, and remember he was a propagandist for the BBC, for the British during the Second World War. George Orwell, who once was a policeman and a journalist, and then became a propagandist, and then basically a whistleblower, said this is where it's going. They're going to change the past. And the trouble with these monuments is you can't argue with them. They're kind of concrete proof of, or metal proof in some cases, of what you're saying. And so these things are markers. And it's biblical. God told Joshua to make a pile of rocks to mark the place where they crossed through the Jordan River and so on. And when people come here, you know, raise us up, Ebenezer, hitherto at the Lord helped us. And so there's continuing in the Bible to remember, and there's a lot of commands in the Bible, remember, remember. And all these things are written down for our admonition, that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. All these things were written for our instruction as examples for us. And so history tells us what has worked, what hasn't worked, what's good, what's bad, what's excellent and praiseworthy, what's totally despicable. And so we learn from history. And if we learn from history, we will be wise. And of course, evil politicians who've got evil goals don't want you to know what's going on. So they mobilize the people perhaps to destroy these monuments, which is a crime. But it's more than that right now. I think a lot of the attacks on monuments is a distraction. It's a distraction from what the governments are busy with. So if you want to pick somebody's pocket or steal somebody's handbag, you need to distract them. Maybe you've got a team. They do the distracting, you do the stealing. And so these mobs may not understand that in attacking the monuments, they're just helping a bunch of bankster, New World Order, criminal politician parasites to get away with their looting, thieving, scheming, taking away people's freedoms, or whatever their goal is. And so the war against history is a war against freedom and knowledge and education. Other comments? Yes. It is. We had actually a whole presentation, and I've got the notes back, the murder of the Russian royal family, basically at the Council of Vienna, Congress of Vienna, in 1815, which ended the Napoleonic Wars, 25 years of Napoleonic French Revolutionary Wars. The Rothschilds managed to convince all the powers of Europe to adopt a central bank controlled by him, except the Tsar. Tsar Alexander I would not accept that. And Lord Rothschild threatened him. He said, I will destroy you, your empire, and your family. And, of course, the Tsar took extra precautions. But a number of Tsars were murdered and assassinated in office. But they still stayed in power. And the anarchists were obviously working for that goal. But the way how not only the Tsar was murdered, but every member of his family, right down to his four daughters and his son and his wife, it indicated a hit. It was a vindictive, occultic, brutal murder. And so it had all the... And there are those who have documented and written books that this was actually an occultic hit serving the cause of the New World Order bankers, or I call them banksters, cross between gangster and bankster. So it was very vindictive. It was very deliberate and wasn't even necessary. They could have exiled him.
Do you know if there are any descendants that survived?
Well, there would be other descendants of, for example, the brother of the Tsar, but his own family was completely wiped out in that one instance in Ekaterinburg. The Russian Orthodox Church has declared the entire family saints, and as you know, they've built some magnificent monuments to him. But it's extraordinary, the vindictiveness, even under Gorbachev, they destroyed the very house where he was murdered because people were coming there to lay flowers and commemorate. And so you can see the vindictiveness of the communists to try and wipe out the memory, but it's not working. The Russians are now more open to this. In fact, as we showed in that presentation, which is online, PowerPoint and the video on that presentation, the Russian government, the Attorney General, they've all vindicated. They were victims. They're innocent. And the church has declared them saints and martyrs. And there's no doubt whatsoever what was done and who did it and why they did it now. There's been a lot of investigations. Yes. Talking about monuments.
Yeah.
Specific, yes.
So if you look at the sheer size of the Egyptian monuments that they depicted to the pharaohs, I just want to hear from you, is there a hint at the giants and the Nephilim that might have ruled Egypt?
You know, it's possible, but certainly what I think the outsized monuments that you get in the Soviet Union and in the ancient Egyptians was this idea of they're larger than life and they're gods, they're giants, because the idea back then was the gods were like us, they're human, but they're bigger than us and they're more powerful than us. That's just the Greek and Roman kind of look and the Egyptian idea. The moment you became a pharaoh, you became a god. That was their logic. And the Caesars, it worked the same way. And that's why the way that the Lincoln Memorial is set up, which is another story entirely, where he's sitting on a throne, a Roman throne, a Roman imperial throne. That actually says, in this temple, as in the hearts of her people, for whom he saved the union, is enshrined forever. I mean, it's religious terminology. So, and it's colossal. I've been to the Lincoln Memorial. It's out of all proportion to any normal monument. It's like the Americans and the FDR, who built this, had decided to elevate Lincoln to a god of America, a part of what they call a state religion. It's not just a reminder, a monument to remember what the person did. This is beyond that, when you have a temple like that, and with such gargantuan size sitting on a throne. There was no throne in America. You had no empire. It wasn't an imperial. Yeah, should have had a chair. Why a throne? And even using the fascist symbols of Italy, which Mussolini was ruling at that time, the symbol that was on all their planes, that's what he's got his hands on in this Lincoln Memorial. So it's quite extraordinary. That really is idolatry. So there's a line between a memorial that is reminding us and an idol which you need to worship. And the communists with their idols of Lenin and Marx and so on, I mean, those are plainly idols that need to be brought down. Just like the Protestants saw statues of Jesus on the cross or suffering, they said, but he's not on a cross, he is risen from the dead, we serve a risen Savior, he's died once for all. And so some Protestants went so far as to even attack Catholic items of devotion, which Luther actually condemned. He said, you shouldn't do that, you don't understand, this can be a means of devotion for some people. But other reformers like Knox saw all religious statues as idolatry and had to be removed. So you've got the battle. Some said, well, let's move it to a museum. Others said, we've got to destroy it. So that's iconography, iconoclasm, where they decide we're going to destroy a religious item because it's an idol. So I fully understand why, after the Soviet Union came down, 26,000 statues of Lenin and Karl Marx were pulled down too. I mean, 26,000 is a bit ridiculous. To have a couple of statues of Lenin to remind you he lived this way, he was born, and so on, okay. But you know, every blasted village in the Soviet Union had to have had a statue of Lenin. So they pulled them down, most of them. I don't know if there's many left. They've apparently got a park or somewhere where you can go and wipe your shoes on them. They're lying around. There's junkyards piled up of old. If you've seen, which was James Bond film where they actually had a scene in one of these junkyards where they're just piled up with old Soviet statues. You know, here's Marx and there's Lenin and there's hammers and sickles. I mean, what do you do with those things? Oh, yes.
I think you're saying with the people pulling them down, then resurrect new ones.
Probably. That may not be the intention now, but that's inevitably what happens. So, basically, it was said most bluntly by Karl Marx, and we've got his quotes, and we've got the leaflets outside in the hallway, the heart and soul of Karl Marx. New gods need to be installed, he said. So you've got to pull down the old history to give people new history. You've got, it's like the mentality of in the army, when we were brought in the army, the first thing I had to do was break you down until you've got nothing. They destroy you, basically. You break your spirit, and then they build you up a new character, where everything now is built around your unit and so on. So it's that kind of mentality, but now as a nation, they want to destroy all your old attachments. So the Frankfurt School of Marxism, the cultural Marxism, they said, every tie of blood, soil, family, race, nation, faith must be destroyed. We've got to destroy every tie. And so to create a new global, new world order system of a one world government, one world economy, one world religion, what do you need? We've got to destroy the nationhood, the familyhood, the cohesion. That's why they want a genderless, familyless, nationless group of people all dependent on the state, where you need handouts from the government. And of course, if you don't behave yourself, it's just withhold that. And you've got no more means of self-dependence to manage. So this is the goal of COVID-19 lockdowns and so on. Is make people so dependent on the state. You've killed little businesses, family businesses, independence. Now people are totally dependent on the state. And they will graciously give you the crumbs every now and then and keep you dependent on them. But what they don't want is self-sufficient, self-governing people who are self-disciplined. I mean, they hate people like the Four Trekkers and the pioneers who did everything themselves and didn't need the government for anything. They even bought their own cannon and gunpowder along. They were completely self-sufficient. And they just want the government to leave them alone. Those sort of people government doesn't like. Like the Kulaks, these farmers in Ukraine. They're all self-sufficient. They didn't need the government for anything. They've made everything themselves. They want you to come into what they call a collective farm, which is just one step from a concentration camp. You now live in a barracks on a farm that your grandparents used to own. And you no longer own anything and you're not self-sufficient. That's why Ceausescu in Romania was taking people away from farms and moving them into agri-industrial centers where he had everyone in blocks of flats. Because if you've got a house and a garden, you could grow some crops and you could have a primitive in your house. But if you're in a block of flats, you can be spied on. You've got no independence. You can't even grow any extra pots. I mean, maybe if you've got a balcony, you might have a little pot plant, but that's not enough. So they wanted to shove everyone into these ugly blocks of flats. We call them Ceausescu flats. These horrible high-rise. We've got no independence. And the neighbors always peeking around the door through the peephole to see who's coming to visit you, reporting it to the local coron. Sorry, KGB.
You mentioned New World Order. I would like to ask you what you believe is behind that.
The New World Order?
Yes.
If you take Romans 13 in the Bible, it speaks about Satan having a false prophet who promotes the beast, which is basically a satanic figure on earth, and he wants a one world government, one world religion, one world economic system. If we look at the world, we've got a few theories, and they all seem to overlap. You've got the Council on Foreign Relations, you've got the Bilderbergers, you've got the Illuminati, you have the Freemasons. There's a group of different one-world-order groups that are, and of course the United Nations is an obvious front. The World Health Organization, the World Council of Churches are obvious fronts for these different goals, International Monetary Fund and so on. But I believe that behind it all is Satan, although the people concerned may be thinking in terms of power, ideology, communism is a major force in many of their minds. And obviously, these people think that centralization is good, decentralization is bad. Whereas we're convinced centralization is bad and decentralization is very good, which is biblical, more freedom. So what's behind it? I think at its core and heart, there's a hatred for God. There's a hatred for Christianity. There's a hatred for freedom. And what they want is control. And the curse of particularly why they hate the Europeans is you've got these horrible people like Martin Luther standing up saying, my conscience has kept the word of God, unless I'm convinced by scripture and by clear reasoning, or give me liberty or give me death, no taxation without representation. You know, these sort of people are the bane of a New World Order crowd. These people who've got a conscience and have got an independent stand and they don't care what the experts say. They're more concerned with logic and scripture. And so what can they do with you? Except, as they said, the cultural Marxism, they said, the only thing that WASPs, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, are good for is fertilizer. You've just got to kill them and put them in the ground. And they're absolutely worthless, because the biggest problem in the world, actually, when you get down to it, is Christians. Christians who think for themselves and who say, no, you're wrong. That's what they hate. And we might be the biggest obstacle to them. You know, we're not interested in their vaccination programs. We're not interested in their compulsory lockdowns. We're not interested in their compulsory masks. We're not interested in any of the things they give us. And then a whole lot of us homeschool. So you can imagine why they're angry, because they want to tell you this is what's important and this is what you meant to think about it and this is what's news and this is what's true and that's been fact-checked by people and that's false. Do you know who the first fact-checker was? Satan.
Yes,
they are. Yeah. Has God said?
Yeah.
And he didn't. Lucifer fact-checked. He didn't say, you'll die if you break my commands. So what I think we're facing is very clearly an Antichrist agenda at its heart. And that's why I think the heart and soul of Karl Marx is key. The man was obviously a Satanist, and he was obviously occultic in his motivations. And Alexander Solzhenitsyn summed it up like that, that the world's never before seen such a godlessness, so organized, so militarized, so tenaciously malevolent as that of communism. And to achieve their goals, they need people entirely devoid of national or religious spirit.
And I think that's probably also why Trump is hated globally, because he's probably the only human being, like him or not, that can withstand pressure.
Yeah, as far as global leaders go, yes, definitely. Mm. Yeah, it's got to frustrate them. Have you noticed the American elections, which is moving into high gear because they're only about 5 weeks away, and they're hysterical, saying that it doesn't matter what happens, we can't accept another trial. Even if he wins the election, we must get the military to step in, he's got to be deposed, we need this. They're all over the place. The entire Democratic bunch is working themselves into frenzy. That whether he wins or not, they're going to seize power. And the riots and everything must continue through the elections. And basically, we'll keep rioting and burning the country down until we're in power. That's what they're saying. And if you doubt that, you just got to go on to Fox News, see Tucker Carlson tonight, and he'll show you the videos, and you actually hear it from these characters. It's like a Monty Python script. Just unbelievable. These people are devoid of all common sense right now, going absolutely berserk on the streets. But there's resistance, not just in America. 1 million people marched in Berlin against masks and lockdowns. In fact, they've done more than once, haven't they?
I think 1.7.
Well, the whole Unter den Linden was plainly packed from side to side, one side to the other, past the Brandenburg Gate. That's a lot of people. That could have been easily way up to that. And also because many people can't let it be known because they might lose their job.
Yeah.
Well, Goodyear, for example, said they'd fire anyone who votes Trump.
Huh?
Goodyear. Yeah, that's just one of them.